How do we join with others to achieve and experience more and get in flow as a unified team? This is the question we ask each episode in the Unified Team podcast. Here's your host, Rob McPhillips.
As I was running off this hill, I would probably see 5 meters. Like, it was such a thick fog. And then what came to my mind is very often my clients use, or people in general kind of use this expression, there's this fog in front of me. Having worked with many people, often I know that it's not something you really figure out, like, what's there. And as I was running in the fog, it's just interesting that when you are like 5 meters ahead of you, you can't see anything. But when you run there, you see very clearly what's there. And then when you look back where you came from, it's now you cannot even see where you came from. It's such an interesting thing when you're doing something really big, meaning like you just finished your career, you want to build something for your own. The future is not clear, but you know that you cannot go back into the past because somehow the life isn't there anymore. Often people unfortunately stop and try to figure out what's there, while really it is through the going into the fog or into the unclarity where you gain the clarity. It never occurred to me how interesting it is that you can, in 5 meters in front of you, can't see anything. You go there and it's clear. You look back where you came from and you don't see.
There's like pockets of fog.
Yes.
It's a fog here and then it's clear and then it's a fog again. What immediately comes to mind to me is whenever I think of solving a problem, I think you have to go up. It's about transcendence. I had in mind when you were saying that, you were probably going to say it's like changing your state by rising up and you rise above the fog.
That's also part of it. Is one of the main things I've learned is when we are like stuck in some problem is to never... don't try to solve it. If a client comes with a problem, I never go with them, let's solve it. Because like you said, a lot of the times when you really like gain perspective, yeah, the problem is there. Let's really get connected with who you are, what's important. Let's look at it from the perspective. And many times either it's actually not a problem or it becomes very clear. But like you said, the state changes. So much of the problems we face or problems we create comes indeed from being in a state that just is very foggy.
Sorry. It's interesting because I love to solve problems and it's something I have to hold myself back from just jumping in. Because if someone comes to you with a problem, it's like an ego boost and you feel good. Oh, yeah, I've solved that for them. And so there's a lot of attachment to being the one that comes up with an answer on that. It takes a lot of maturity and emotional regulation to be able to say, okay, no, and hold back from immediately jumping in. I'm guessing that's part of what's come on your journey.
Yes, that's both in when I was in leadership position, but I was really lucky to be sent to amazing leadership courses and I learned coaching a bit. I think the first time I started dealing with this, indeed, this what you are sharing, do not jump in because I wanted to, as a leader, to be seen as useful. And to me, the idea was that if I know how to solve something, then I'm useful. And then like, all good. But then I, of course, realized that at one point I had 13 direct reports. And if I'm going to solve everybody's things, I will be just swamped and my team will not grow. So what really changed me when after a leadership course, read a book called The Coaching Habit, Say Less, Ask More, and Change Your Leadership Forever. And then seeing the true questions, people actually could recognize what's the actual problem and how to solve it. And of what I also recognized, and this is huge part of professional coaching training, is to never jump in to solve people's problems, because we might even solve a completely wrong problem. Is that the right problem to solve? How was it created in the first place? So all this kind of true experience, seeing that it works a lot better to not jump into the problem. And I think working with this inner thing that I can be valuable, useful, even without being the hero of the story. That was a big part of, in general, in my coaching, in my leader journey, is to removing this need to be the hero.
Okay. I'm really interested to hear that. So what did young Nicky want?
How far do we want to go?
What was your earliest, when you first thought of working, people want to be a train driver or a footballer, yes, or a policeman or something?
The first professions that I wanted to have was an NHL hockey player or a professional chef. Those were the two. Because my dad was and is really amazing chef. Like, he cooked all these like really interesting exotic foods, and I really liked doing it with him. There's a lot of creativity in it. And then I played ice hockey, and that seemed like this would be a pretty cool profession. And well, that's certainly there wasn't anything big or awareness of why those professions. Eventually that thing didn't happen. I didn't make it to NHL, but I did go to culinary school for 3 years and graduated from there. And then I was just thinking during the morning run about my leadership journey. They would say that I've been in leadership for 15 years. But in reality, I would say only eight or nine years. The younger me was a lot more driven and into about the spiritual side. I think that's from a very, very early age on, where I recognized that, yeah, I can get a profession, I can get this or that, but there's all these questions that I actually want to have answered. So that may be a big part of the younger me today also. But I wasn't really convinced that the career or work will, let's say, solve the things.
That's interesting. So when did the spiritual journey or the spiritual seeking?
I think that the seed was laid very early. I don't know how can I remember it, but when I was 3 years old, my great-grandfather died, and my family line is Christian Orthodox. And why this is important to say is that in Christian Orthodox funeral, the casket is open, and there's a tradition that you kiss the forehead of the dead person. I remember my grandfather lifting me. I kissed my great-grandfather. And then the following night, I couldn't sleep because I realized my parents will die one day. Like, death became, oh, like, there's this thing called death. And then I'm not going to go through every stage, but already at 12 years old, I was asking questions. Okay, what, not just who we are, but what we are. How did we come here? What about after death? And then when my grandma got cancer, we are very close with her. I think I was 15 or maybe a bit older. And I felt like church or priest or my parents or nobody had any answers to it. Nobody had any spiritual side to contribute to dealing with it. I became really angry kind of to society and the church. I resigned from the church and all that because there was no answers. Read so many books about spiritual and science. And eventually that seeking led that I went into the Buddhist meditation center. And that's also where the seeking did end. The seeking did end there.
As in, you found a peace or you found an answer?
I found the answer. I've gained some experiences. I'm not saying that I got enlightened, nothing like that. But more like, I think there is, in spiritual seeking, there is the seeking for the path, then finding the path, and then it becomes about walking the path. It's interesting that, for example, in Buddhism, of course, it's one of the major religions, but it is not religion in the sense that it is purely based on Buddha's one of the most famous sentences, don't believe everything that I said, because I said it be your own guiding light. And so it became the practice to walk in the unique path. So it stopped being something that I was seeking for anymore. And then I started then, because the seeking ended and my team told me, like, it would be good for you to get into the society. You can do some beneficial things in the society. Then I met my partner also, and we decided to have family. And that's when I was years old. That's when I first time really seriously started to consider a career, when I was like, yeah, well, this is actually interesting. I can make something out of it. And slowly that eventually led that I became very interested about leadership. I'm mentioning it because I know that for your audience to understanding that is important, or like one of the main aspects that they are here listening for.
So this journey of not enlightenment, but finding peace, that began what kind of age? When was this time when you became disillusioned with your religion?
The interesting thing, by the way, is that I gained a lot more respect to Christianity after practicing in the Buddhism for a very long time. But around between 18 and 23, I would say I had my life with my friends and so on. And then I had my life where I was reading all this different spiritual tradition, science, and writing about things. One evening, I was 23 years old. And at that point, I had stopped drinking or smoking weed or anything like that. It just didn't feel good. But most of my friends were doing it. And there was this one evening, I would say around 3 a.m., you were at my friend's apartment. Everybody had passed out. They had smoked or drank too much. And I was, forgive me if I will not curse, but I looked around and asked like, Nikki, what the fuck are you doing here? Really? And I walked out of the apartment. I walked kilometers in Finland in minus back to my home. And since then, I went to work, came back from home, read, I was writing, exercising and meditating. And then one of my best friends, so I had, at this point, I didn't have many friends because I really left that group of friends. And was one of my best friends who we were in this journey of seeking, he went in the Buddhist meditation center and he said, you should come. And I was in my typical arrogant style. I don't need a teacher. I can do all of this by myself. One day I decided, well, okay, I'll come with you. And when I went there in an unexplainable way, I just felt like I had arrived to home. And during the meditation, all of a sudden, like all the doubts faded. I had some tears. And that was really strange to me because I'm quite a critical person. So I always also read science along with the spirituality. And like I mentioned, I was more like, I don't want to trust this. I want to do this on my own. So it was a really unexpected experience to me. And then the people were normal. There were lawyers, nurses, corporate people, construction yard workers in the center. So I was like, oh, these are just normal people, but they have such an interesting mind and they had a different kind of energy. And then eventually I went for a retreat, met my teacher, and that's what it's been for past 50 years. I lived in the meditation center for 3 years or a bit over. And I went to the center for a decade and do retreats. And then 5 years ago, I can stop doing that. I always kept my connection with my teacher and some of my friends from the center, but that was time for me when I left those circles and I practice every day, but it's has become just a normal, natural part of life.
You were frustrated, you were angry, nobody had given you since that made sense, that worked for you. So was it the Buddhist philosophy that led you to a frame that brought you peace of being in?
Right.
Or was it the daily practices?
Yeah, it was experiences. So one of the first experiences that really created a shift in me was that for 2 weeks, I think I was 24 at this age. 2 weeks I had been ruminating about my boss, he's so stupid and why can't she understand and all this. And then I also was really stressed out about a deadline at work, which now that I look back, it probably was connected. Then at that point, I was really impressed about the Buddhist philosophy. It really made sense to me, but I had never meditated. And I decided, okay, what the heck? Like, what is there to lose? I'm going to try to meditate. And somehow I sat down and 2 hours went like this. After I came out of it, my mind was so clear and spacious that I realized actually all that stuff about my boss was just total nonsense. Like all these conversations with her happened in my head. Actually, she was really trying to be helpful, but I was the idiot in that. And it took me 2 hours to finish the deadline thing, which I had been like postponing and procrastinating. And then two things happened. One was like, wow, like just from meditation, this happens. Other thing was like, I wonder how many other things are happening inside me that I'm bothered by or I'm thinking and they're not true at all. And that was the first that got me into meditation. And then I had, which I will not go into detail unless you want to ask, but I had some experience, especially in the retreats, that beyond the doubt made me convinced that we are a lot more than our body on our brain. So it was experiences that my teachers emphasized, practice and experience, which I also in my work with clients, yes, I give information, but really what's changing us is we do the internal work and do the external work, but information is not really changing us so much.
Yeah, I can see that, because tell someone something, but they're still going to fall back to their operating system. And it's a significant emotional experience that's going to change your perspective and change the way that you operate. Yeah, I think it might be interesting to, if you're happy to share about your experiences.
I'll share two of the first two first ones. So one was as I was preparing for the retreat. It sounds very exotic name, but it's in Tibetan, it's called Pova. It literally means sending your consciousness through the top of your head. That's what it means. And I was preparing for it, and we needed to do a lot of preparation work for that. And during one of the practice sessions, all of a sudden, my awareness exploded to every direction. There was nothing else but just this immense spaciousness, which was full of bliss and love. And I really probably for 20 minutes was just tears flowing, because it was like completely just being loved and bliss. And I remember after that, I sent a SMS back then, phones, there was no smartphones. But I sent an SMS to my mom, something like, what we really are is this place and space, and it's so amazing. That experience for a long time became an obstacle to me, because I wanted to replicate it. And of course, you cannot, then you are already blocking it. Other thing was when I went to the retreat, one point of the retreat, I had this similar experience, and there was so much joy going through my body that it was just impossible to hold it in. There was such a joy bursting through. And what was interesting is that there were hundreds of us. And then my teacher looked there at me and said, you just got rid of your fear of death. And it was impressive. I still had a doubtful mind. I was still thinking that he could just say that. And then we had a break between the sessions. And in between the sessions, I had this thought that what if one day I will break my skull accidentally and there will be an iron plate like put up here, because that's what is done, or whatever material it is, then the energy cannot flow from here. And I didn't say that to anybody. That I was just like wondering about that. And then the next session started. I was sitting in the front row. And when my teacher came to sit in front of us, he looked at me and said, don't worry, even if you have metal plate over here, it will still go through. And again, two things happened. One was that, wow, the other one was like, shit, he can read my thoughts. And that was then, oh, that thought shouldn't have been, whoa, what about this one? It became really funny. That, and those kind of experiences kept coming up. One more about my teacher was in one of the retreats. This was years later than what I just explained. I was separated with my girlfriend, and I don't think I handled it really well towards her. So I felt really guilty. Then I went to the session. I was like, felt really anxious here, but nobody could see anything because I was still in the state of I'm such a realized spiritual person that nothing bothers me ever. And I was sitting there, and then my teacher just looked at me and said, your energy channels look like a broken Christmas tree. It's going all over the place. Like, what's going on? Again, that was like, okay, wow. Some things like that.
Yeah, I can imagine that's quite confronting. You're like, don't read these thoughts, change your thinking.
Yeah. It was all the stuff you don't want to come to your mind, to your mind.
Okay, so you mentioned that you practice every day. So what is your practice?
Yes. So in Tibetan Buddhism, there's a thing called Nyendra, which sounds exotic. It literally means preliminary practices. So for us to go deeper into meditation, there's four things that are really useful to do. One is to prepare the energies of the body and stabilize the mind. Because more, especially one of the reasons for Westerners why it's difficult for Westerners to relax is that there's so much suppressed stuff. And when we relax, it arises. And it's difficult to go deep into meditation. So that's the first step. And the second step is purifying the subconscious mind, especially from all kinds of repressed emotions and so on. And I'm not going to go through all of them, but basically those create a foundation for deeper meditations. And it usually takes 10 years to do it. I had life situations and I've kind of commitment to, I did it in 5 years. And since then, so about 10 years ago, I got this main meditation from my teacher, which is how would I go into it. Works with really deep aspects of the energies and the awareness of the mind, especially balancing the feminine and masculine. So simple answer would be I meditate with 60 or 90 minutes in the morning. I do that practice. And then through the day, I do short sessions, which can be honestly literally quiet for 10 minutes. I meditate quite a lot with my clients. One of the reasons people work with me is that they want to learn meditation or use visualization. I do. You might be familiar with Wim Hof. So I do the breath work, which, I mean, it's not fully his. He has done amazing work with it, but something similar. So those are my main practices. And then just doing my best to be aware throughout the day, like in this moment, being aware, where are the things that I'm sharing coming from? Being aware that when, as a part of me, just try to twist something in what I'm saying, like all those, being aware in the moment, being relaxed in the body. Those are my main practices.
Okay. So I know immediately when you say you meditate every day morning for 60 to 90 minutes, the first thing people are going to say is, how do you, I couldn't have time, I've got kids.
We also have kids. When 10 years ago, we had a 10-year-old and a 1-year-old. The 10-year-old was my stepson. And now we have a 10-year-old and she is our daughter. And then we have a foster child, which actually she was adopted literally a week ago. So we'll have get another one, but she was 4 months old. So I do understand that. And when our daughter was at a very young age, she would wake up at 6 and I need to meditate. And it's not a luxury for me. I really need it. I don't know how to. I think it would be very difficult to imagine if there wasn't this stability of the mind and so on, to how much more difficult life would be. And so there's the commitment to do it, that I wake up early to do it. It's not easy always. Actually, most of the time, it's not something that I just jump there and it's easy. Other thing is, it's really good that you're asking that question. I needed to develop that habit. And also, 15 years ago, I meditated 10 minutes. That was 10 minutes. After a month, 15 minutes. And then after I've meditated for many years, then 20 minutes become comfortable. Now 90 minutes is easy and comfortable, but it certainly wasn't like that. So when my clients, I usually recommend them to do 5 minutes. Some clients start with 1 minute and then we will go from there. So I quickly understand that how I'm going to find the time for it. I think that either we get to the point where we realize, I don't know if there's other options, because I certainly don't want to live in a way that my mind reacts and wanders about, and I don't want my body and mind to be out of energy. And so it's like I need to do it.
I did Wim Hof for a little while.
Yes.
And I did the cold showers, and I looked at the minimum effective dose from what I could see in science was 30 seconds. So it's like, okay, 30 seconds cold shower, that's fine. So what would you say is the minimum effective dose?
That's a really good question. I often get that question. I use often the metaphor of think about going to the gym. If somebody goes to the gym 3 times a week for 5 minutes, then that's the results you're going to get. Like, it's better than not going. But if you go 4 times half an hour, you're going to see results. So it's really, I will answer your question also. But most people, it takes 10 minutes for the mind to settle in the normal state. What I mean by that is that most Westerners are in the low anxiety state. If you look at the data or statistics, it's 77% of adults are under low level anxiety to the point where it's affecting their physical health, which from the brain perspective, it means the brain is in the high bay, which means that your mind is really not cohesive and it's like going really fast. So it takes 10 minutes to get to normal state, which is great. Like, it's nice to be in the normal state. About 20 minutes and it starts falling into deeper brain waves where it's clear but it's relaxed. And after minutes, you can start seeing that body gets really relaxed, the mind becomes more spacious. And after that, you start seeing deeper layers of the mind, like in general. And if you spend time there, then more and more naturally, our mind becomes familiar with that state and it stays there more longer easily. Also, other thing that is really useful to understand about meditation is, because so many people come and say, I can't meditate. And then how do you know? I have so many thoughts and I'm so distracted. Oh, that's meditation. You sit there, your mind goes to what's for dinner. Oh, back here. What did that person say yesterday? Or back here. And that the moment we catch ourselves, we are aware of meditating. And when a person every day does that, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, then they're constantly developing the habit of the mind coming back to the present moment. So it's good to think about. That's why some often use gym or exercise as an example, because we know that repetitions actually do matter. So same with meditation. If you pull your mind back to the present moment 100 times, that muscle is getting stronger. So anything's better than nothing. But I would say like 10 minutes you can start. Well, according to science, 30 days, 15 minutes a day is increasing your focus for 15% and lowering stress by 12%. So there is that.
So what comes to mind is like you have clutter on your computer and you run a program and it just clears it. And so the computer runs better. It's basically having more RAM. So the more, the longer that you meditate for, the more RAM you have and the less clutter you have in your head.
That's a really good one. Yeah, that's a good way to look at it.
So at the peak state, it means basically my uneducated view is at the peak state, you've got much more focus, much more mental power. So you can focus on a problem or a situation and you've got much more RAM, much more ability, much more mental power. So really for that kind of meditation, it's someone who needs to think at a really high quality, who's making big decisions, who doesn't need to be affected by emotions and biases, needs to be really able to process a lot of information and use it. So the more, like the more knowledge work that you do, the more valuable meditation is from a productivity perspective.
For sure, because your brain becomes relaxed. And when it's relaxed, it's able to process the information in a lot more faster and cohesive way. And what I mean by that is that we've all experienced a flow state. And what flow state on the brain level means that all the things are firing together at the same time, are connected together. So that's why you are like accessing so much more of your memory, your experience, your knowledge, your ideas. You're accessing all that at the same time while the brain is not wondering about other stuff. And that's, meditation helps us to get in that state. Here's the important thing is that meditation doesn't fix everything. For example, if we don't have a vision for life, if it's not clear, why am I doing this thing that I'm doing? And it's not really clear, what am I doing and how am I doing it? If those things, if we haven't made those things clear, then we might have a very spacious and calm mind, but we don't necessarily have that robust energy to do it. For those two things, I use visualization for to create that, create strong vision about what I'm doing, the big picture vision, but also to create the clarity. That's what visualization is super useful for. And all this took, I'm adding this to what you were saying, because I think that was really good description of a person who needs to go on that level of performance. If they have meditation habit, I know why I'm doing this and what I'm doing, more or less, because we can don't know everything. Then everybody can remember how it is to be in the flow state, which is almost like you are in some way, you are even there. It's just a very clear space, and even problems don't appear as problems. It's just like immediately the brain is figuring out how to work with it.
Just on that point, I've meditated and I can feel like a great peace, and you can feel clarity and ideas and better quality thinking. Visualization is something I know sports people always say you need to visualize. It's something I've never, maybe it's because I've undeveloped it, but it's not something I've ever found any success with. And whenever I've listened to a guided meditation, it just irritates me. Leave me alone. Let me just have quiet. So I don't know if I'm missing something.
Visualization is one form of meditation. There's so many different meditations. What are we needing at the moment? One can think about it in this way, that meditation, that our mind has two aspects. It has clarity, aware, like it's able to be conscious and it's able to know things. And that part through meditation can become very stable. Our mind also has expression, it has energy, it has creativity, it has movement. And visualization is more to train that part of the mind, the part of the mind that is more responsible for all the content that is going on in the mind, all the stuff that is appearing in the mind. Through visualization, we are learning to direct what's happening in our mind, to direct what we're paying attention to. And when people say to me, sometimes when people say that visualization doesn't work for me, and I often ask them, have you ever thought about a future scenario and being stressed out about it? And everybody says, yes, of course, we've all done that. That is visualization. You're thinking about a future scenario and we feel emotions about it. It's just, there's a lot better ways to use visualization. And I think it's really good for productivity and focus and things like that. For example, how I use it is, if I'm even, let's say, having this meeting with you, then I don't spend a lot of time with it. But yesterday evening, I was still relaxed by my bed and just, who do I want to be there? What do I want to remember? Yeah, I want to remember that there's an audience that I'm serving, that what are some topics we might be talking about? Not, okay, what will I say, but just plant some seeds. For example, just yesterday with one client, she's going into potentially challenging conversations. Then we did have a visualization, let's go there. How do you want to feel? Like, confident. Okay, what does it feel like? Do you remember? Like, how does it feel like to be confident in the body? And then we get her into that emotion and then asking her, how would you behave from that emotion? Because the main thing with visualization from brain perspective is that when we are embodied in the visualization, when we think that we are doing something, then limbic brain is attaching emotion to that behavior and motivation. When we detach ourselves, when we look at ourselves from outside, okay, how does it look like when you are there? How are you behaving and talking? Then the, especially neocortex and frontal lobe, they will map our behavior into the emotion. So it's really creating this image about ourselves and behavior that has emotion and clarity. So that's what visualization is really good for. And there is 3% of human population that have been called aphantasia, which is that they literally don't see images. And one more thing, then I'll end this, hopefully it answers the question, is of course, it's not that we see things the same way as we see now. But if we close our eyes, and if I would ask then someone you really love or like, how do they look like, or imagine chocolate ice cream, we can see that in, but in just in a bit different way. So it's not about creating a real image like how our eyes see it. Hopefully that's give some life to visualization.
Obviously, I do preempt things and visualize what they're going to be like. But I think it's more, I don't want to be directed in it. I want to do that. Yeah, no, I've never really consciously, I'd rather get on and work towards it rather than visualize what it's going to be.
Now, if there's something really important, based on our tendencies and what we want, then there are different meditations. There are meditations that are simple and you are just focused on breathing. And for a person who has a mind that can do that, their mind is not super busy and active naturally, those are really great meditations for them. Actually, the more simple the meditation, the more difficult it is on some level. That's not fully true. But then if you have a person, let's say like me, I have a naturally lot of ideas and stuff popping up in my mind. Then for me, it's better to do meditation where there is stuff going on that I need to focus on, because then it's playing into my tendency. Also, if somebody wants to really like, okay, I want to find more silence and peace and this spaciousness and clarity of the mind, I'm like focus for activity and those things are really good and I have my ways, then there's no need use visualization or that it, to finish what I'm now trying is basically, it's good to use the kind of meditations that work for us. If you don't feel like you want to be guided, which is completely kind of natural response, then it's not that you are losing anything. You are not losing anything. It's just you are using something that is useful to you.
I've never consistently, significantly meditated, but I meditate and I do from time to time. But I do notice, obviously, like all of us are trying to find answers. And I do remember there coming a time where I just became aware of there was silence in my head. It's like all the voices that had switched off. So I do have ability to, because obviously I still get distracted and things still come to mind, but I like silence and I can't work if there's any noise. Like I've been in a co-working place and people are talking. I can't go to a coffee shop and really focus. Yes. So, yeah, any noise can irritate me quite easily. In the time that we've got left to be able to answer, I'd be interested in your journey in leadership, but also I think people in leadership have, we talked about, it's such a difficult job. So many things and the growth that's needed and the stability and the ability to keep your ego out of things is so challenging that I think anyone in any kind of leadership position needs this kind of balance. So if you could speak from your experience and how you help leaders.
Okay, so let's see if this is useful. So how I work with myself and how I work with leaders is first exactly what you were saying, to understand that it is really, it is a challenging job. And why is it a challenging job? And I think this is really useful for the listeners to really imagine and see themselves in this. when we are in a leadership position, first there is we ourselves. And we, in when we are leading people, let's not even go there, but even within ourselves, there are contradicting priorities, there are expectations towards ourselves. There are all kinds of unconscious things about how we want to be seen, how we don't want to be seen. And that's already a lot to deal with. And so that's the first layer. We are already operating from a place that is very complex, can be very complicated. Now add to there that there's a layer around you where it's your team, and your team has expectations, conscious or unconscious, towards us. And then there is what is expected from us and our team, the goals, the results, and that might involve our superiors, people above us, and all kinds of things. That's where we are in that. That's really worth recognizing and saying to ourselves, hey, it is not an easy position to be. And the main thing that I eventually had the courage to do, because my difficulty was other people's emotions, I would internalize them, which many leaders do, and I would feel guilty about it. And that creates a very difficult scenario, because as leaders, we sometimes need to make decisions, or we are actually all the time doing something somebody can be or will be bothered by, especially if we are in a situation where in between our boss, the results that are expected, and those are in contradiction with who we are, what our values are, and with the team. Like, to be in that scenario is like almost impossible to find a peace. Yet it is from peace that we can actually operate in that, and to bring a bit of science here. So when we are in the center of all that, and when we are stressed or worried, when we are not relaxed, our brain works in a very specific way. It works from the belief or perception that there's a threat, a problem that needs to be removed because I don't want to experience this emotion. The problem with that is, in a leadership position or life in general, is that it makes us see, literally, it makes us to perceive events, people, and things that either they are causing more stress, or they are a tool or a way to get out of the stress, or they're none of those, so they're going to be ignored. From physiological perspective, it means that the blood flow of the brain starts to focus on more of the survival parts. The body starts pushing blood into our arms and into our hands, which means that our perception of the world also diminishes to very short term. How do I get rid of this problem? The world appears this narrowed down problems that need to get rid of. We will not have a lot of energy because there's too much cortisol that the body needs to be cleaning up. We literally use ability to be empathetic. The reason why leaders sometimes push a lot of stress and pressure into their team is because they see their team as a way out of that stress. If my team performs well, we get the results and I can relax. But of course, not a conscious thing. That also works other way around. I don't want to demand anything from my team. I don't want to be honest with my team, because then I get stressed about their emotions. But basically, mainly to understand that, and even that, it's not because we are stupid or our brain is stupid. It's a scene that the brain is really thinking that there's a lion in this room and I better get quickly out of here or I'll get eaten. It's not thinking like strategic views or empathy, because it's not what its aim is, to get quickly rid of the problem out of there. And when we are relaxed, not only we will have a lot more energy, but a lot of the ego things falls off. We don't need to be seen as useful because we feel content inside. We will be able to actually understand and see people because there's enough blood going into our frontal lobe. So we are able to be empathetic, we're able to think deep, big picture, and connections. I would say always with the people that I work with, the first thing is, let's get you into a state that is relaxed, that is really aligned with what's important to you in this role. And then maybe you can help your team to get in the same position. If I could only say in two or three sentences for leaders, is find first like inner stability and then start operating from there. Because before that, it's a very messy thing to try to operate in it. There's too much things that can seem to kind of go wrong, and we are trying to create something that is not really possible. And one more thing to your point, because I think it's so important especially these days, to leaders to realize that, yes, look, like you are also a human. It is a difficult position. This might be a controversial thing to say, but I see this a lot in the workplace dynamics. You are not a parent to children. Like your team is not kids, they're adults. Even if that also happens quite a bit, often leaders are subconsciously seen as some kind of, they should be perfect parents. That happens a lot in the workplace, unfortunately. It was really, when I was in the second leadership course that I did, facilitator had this very subtle, interesting moment where he talked about how people, how, what does it mean when people go first? And then he said, but of course, leaders and managers are not people. And then he was quiet for a while. And that, like, exactly, it's like leaders are not easily seen as that they are also humans.
I think that is so true. You see so many things about bad leaders and the statistics of people who lose their jobs because of bad leaders and the impact that can have. But I think it's asking so much of someone. Yeah, that's such a great point that I don't think, I've never heard anyone make that before, but it's powerful. Because it puts into perspective what we're asking. We're asking people to be superhuman.
Yes.
And anyone, whatever job you do, there's going to be some that are great, some that are terrible, and most that are just fairly good at what they do. So I love what you've talked about, because that's exactly the kind of thing that I do in conflict. The first stage is finding calm, and however that is, because the big problem that people have with conflict, so my work is relationships, and the big problem where relationships break is conflict. Conflict stops communication. The lack of communication creates a lack of connection, where people think negatively things of each other. They become more suspicious, lack trust. And it all comes down to the fact that evolutionary conflict historically, or way back in caveman times, conflict was a different tribe or a different species. And so when someone's different in any way, you think they're not like me, there's immediately a threat. And so when there's a conflict, so husband and wife, typically when they become challenged, they have children or something, and they have a different point of view. This is not the person that I thought it was. I thought we had the same values. I thought we wanted the same thing. Yeah. And it's a very human thing that if you look at religion, so Buddhism has over 30,000 denominations of Buddhism. It's because people have had this split. Christianity has over 30,000 denominations. Mm-hmm. It's because as humans, we can agree about the big picture, but the longer we're together, the more we talk, the more points of conflict and difference we're going to find. And though this moves for diversity and inclusion, that's not how people are evolutionarily programmed. We're programmed to be tribal. And so like you say, that any kind of difference makes people feel threatened, which brings in the fight or flight response. And like you say, people don't have access to their brain. They're operating from the reptilian brain.
Yes.
Or even if they're not threatened, they're probably more acting from their limbic brain, which is the emotion of the guilt of other people. How are other people feeling? How's this going? Whereas really what we need to do is, if we've joined together as a collective to achieve something, we need to be focused on the thing. Bond together is on whatever the purpose is of the group that we form. Yeah. So we need to transcend both the fear and the obligations and the responsibilities to the emotions of other people. And we need to be able to make those decisions, which means that we need to be in that heightened state, isn't it?
Yes. And such amazing things there. And actually, continue what you were saying or add to it is that in the past, let's say 100 years, but especially last 50 years, not to even mention the past decades, is religious communities, especially in West, more or less have disappeared, or that it's certainly not a strong thing anymore. While over 100 years ago, that's where people got together. People are a lot more disconnected from other people, their communities, friends, families. And now, since especially in the West, so driven, we are attaching so much our self-worth and value into how we are doing at work, is that we are bringing into workplace like impossible dynamics. Like the workshop place should be like, it should be family, therapy, purpose. Like it should be able to give everything, but it's not able to do it. It doesn't even need to be able to do it. So I think that's one of the things that is very difficult in workplace. As I mentioned already, and to my understanding along the lines that you were saying, that it's like the dynamics are just impossible. There are a lot of children-parent dynamics. The leaders are supposed to respond. Like, how difficult it is to manage our own emotions. To be in harmony with ourselves is a huge task. I don't know if any of us, I know there are people, but to be 100% in harmony with ourselves is an amazing achievement. What about when there are two people? What about when there's 10 people and one person is supposed to be responsible for the harmony of the 10 people? It is an impossible task. I think that conversations about leadership ideally would have a lot more balance around. It is a collaboration between the leader and the team. It's too much responsibility at the moment on the leader's side.
Absolutely. My theory is that a leader is like the container for the group. It's the one that keeps the group and moves the group together best. And I think the leader should have to have the answers. The leader should be the one who can get the answers. The ideas and the innovations can come from anyone. My job is just to create the atmosphere, get people working in the same direction, and to coordinate and support that. The more that the team can work together. So this is why I feel everyone needs to know how to build good relationships, how to deal with conflict. Mm-hmm. And then the other part, which is, I think, individually, we need to be stable before we can, because otherwise, when people are unstable, they're looking for something from the group. They're draining energy for their own, what they want to be recognized, to be validated, to be sympathetic, whatever it is. And all of that is taken away from the team.
Exactly. Yeah, that, like you said, and then what are relationships other than communication? And then if that communication, which is in some way, everything is communication. You don't do something, we are communicating something. But if we can understand exactly what you said, relationship, communication, and then it coming from a stable place, then we are in a good place to operate from.
To finish up, so a leader or someone who's stressed in their work, if you could give them 3 to 5 general tips of what to do.
Yes, three things. Really make it clear to yourself what is the importance of being a leader to every area of your life. How is it impacting your well-being? How is it impacting, how do you want it to impact other people? How do you want it to impact all the different areas of life? Why do you want that impact? Why am I saying that? Is that, and it's directly connected to meaning and purpose. When we go out to work and we really emotionally feel that there's purpose and we are curious and it's interesting and growing, then dopamine gives us energy and resilience. Some amazing thing about dopamine is that it blocks cortisol from attaching into the body. By the way, we need cortisol. We can die without it, but too much cortisol attaches to the body. The body needs to wash it out. Then it doesn't have time to regenerate more energy. Without that, there's no real direction. There's not enough dopamine. Second thing is have some sense for the long term, month, week, and daily. What am I doing? How we will be doing it? And because then we are connecting. What I'm doing today is connected to my long-term vision. That means that I can relax because what I'm doing right now here is important. It's taking me where I want. And I have some image in my mind about what to do today. And definitely don't try to do too much. I would say most people try to do in a week. They are trying to do month worth of work in a week, and it doesn't work. And why I'm saying this is a plan that supports the vision is because then we have more serotonin, and serotonin allows us to not only calm down, but we can choose behaviors. So we are not so reactive to things. We are not falling into impulses and distractions because we've given ourselves path and image of vision, and we've given our steps towards that. And then, of course, we'll move towards that because it's clear that we want to go. If we don't have that, not many of the other things will matter because our mind will be all the time looking for something, wondering about something, trying to protect against something, trying to hold on to something. And that's very distracted, reactive life. And then as a third thing, to have a ritual, a routine, a practice that really allows us to get into that mental state, but also something that we know that, like for me, it's not only meditation, but running. When I struggled with my business a lot on the financial front, it was very difficult, but always helped me. At least I'll be running in the forest come up with some new ideas and come back first, like something that we can rely on, something consistent. Like when you have those three things as a leader, then we'll be in the right state, and very likely we'll be, because the interesting thing about dopamine is that it sparks up more curiosity. And curiosity, of course, makes us all the time better. We're asking questions or wondering about things, learning new things. So those would be my three things to focus on.
Okay, thank you. And if someone was looking to go deeper, what actually would it look like working with you?
Well, first, when people meet me, we'll have 1 hour session where I really understand clearly their present situation, what are the challenges, what is it they don't, what is that they want to change, and then go into why do you want to change this, how do you want life to look like, who do you want to be, what's the gap at the moment. And then I will ask the person, if you were to work with me, what three things would you need to gain from it that it would be truly worth the investment, that it would be valuable. And then I will honestly say if I can help them with that, which means I need to believe in them and I need to see that I can help with them. And I will always tell the people that this we can do because of this is possible because of this. But for example, sometimes people might say, I want to double my salary in 3 months. Then I say, I really can't promise because I don't know where you are at the moment. And from there, build a program for that specific person based on the experience. And also I am certified neuroscience-based coach, so I know how to build the program in a way that it actually fits that person. And it's one-to-one coaching.
And if someone wanted to find out a bit more,
LinkedIn is the best place. That's where I'm active in.
Okay, that's been fascinating.
Thank you for listening. Please like, share, subscribe, and leave a review so we can spread more flow and unify teams. If you're on LinkedIn, please connect with me, Rob McPhillips.